Not much Q&A since there are only three people that I see attendees. But I thought I'd finish off the class with a discussion of corporate welfare, since it is a big form of corporate welfare. And as I usually do in my research, I'll combine some history and economics with this. And I think the story starts with understanding what mercantilism is and was. So I'm going to talk about it in the context of American economic and political history. And what mercantilism was essentially a collection of policies that benefited producers at the expense of consumers. That was the prevailing economic regime of Europe in the 1600s, the 1700s, and at the time of the American founding. And it was basically a corrupt system whereby politically connected businesses curried favor with the kings, and in return they shared some of the loot with the kings, the loot that they made from grants of monopoly, for example, protectionist tariffs to keep competition out, subsidies of various forms, and so forth. And so it was really the ultimate Santa Claus economics. In terms of benefiting businesses in return for giving nothing in return to the consumer. And so at the time of the American founding, this was the prevailing political economic regime in Europe. And this is the type of system that the Americans fought a revolution against. With the famous train of abuses in Thomas Jefferson's Declaration of Independence, listed quite a few economic complaints about cutting off free trade of the colonists and taxation without representation, of course, was sort of the rallying cry. But it was basically this corrupt British mercantilist system that was using the colonists as fodder, as they were using them, as they looked at them as sort of so many chickens waiting to be plucked in terms of the economic policy. And so that's one of the things the colonists revolted against, is being politically plundered and economically plundered by the King of England through this mercantilist economic system. And then after the Revolution, after the American Revolution, there was always a group of men in American politics who wanted to bring this very same rotten system here to the United States, as long as they could be in charge, because they understood that this really was the route to riches and political power, because that's what they knew. That's how the wealthy elite of Europe accumulated riches and power, through mercantilism. And so there was always this battle between the Jeffersonians on one hand, who were more inclined to favor free trade and capitalism, and the Hamiltonians or the Federalists, also sometimes referred to as the Nationalists. And so you had the two great adversaries, Jefferson and Hamilton, really debating over the propriety of corporate welfare in much of their political debates. And Jefferson was very well educated in economics. He had read Adam Smith's Wealth of Nations. He was familiar with a precursor of the Austrian school, the French physiocrats, as they were called, and especially Turgot, spelled T-U-R-G-O-T. Turgot's name is on the wall at the Mises Institute. If you were to walk into the Monticello, Thomas Jefferson's home in outside of Charlottesville, Virginia, today, you would see, the first thing you see is a bust of Turgot, who was the French finance minister, and was also a well-known European free market economist at the time. Jefferson translated Turgot's economic writings into English and brought them to America. And so Jefferson was very well schooled, very well educated in economics, whereas his nemesis, Alexander Hamilton, was not. He was basically an economic ignoramus who was schooled only in sort of the propaganda pamphlets of British mercantilists. And I don't think he ever actually read Adam Smith. He criticized Adam Smith. He criticized the idea of free trade, and he criticized the idea of a free market. But I don't think he, I've written a whole book on Hamilton called Hamilton's Curse, and I don't think he ever actually read The Wealth of Nations. And by the way, there are a number of good books on Hamilton and Jefferson. that William Graham Sumner wrote an excellent biography of Alexander Hamilton. It's just called Alexander Hamilton, and it's on online. If anybody just happens to be interested in following up on one of these old books, William Graham Sumner was a well-known libertarian sociologist and scholar at Yale University at the turn of the 20th century. And so I think the book was published in 1905. And so from the very beginning of the American Republic, you had this great debate over the propriety of corporate welfare. And the so-called nationalists wanted to bring this rotten system to America because, as I said, they understood that it would be a route to riches and power for them and their political associates. The Jeffersonians argued that, well, we just fought a revolution to get rid of a system like this. Why would we want to bring it here? Well, the why is that as long as we're on the receiving end of this corrupt system, it's a good idea. So it was said by the Hamiltonians. But when you were on the paying end, it was a bad idea. And so this animated early America. The biggest debate that occurred right off the bat was debate over the propriety of a central bank. And the first central bank in America was the Bank of North America. It only lasted about a year because its currency was so unreliable that it just disappeared and was privatized because no one trusted the currency. And then the second precursor of the Fed was the Bank of the United States. And Jefferson and Hamilton argued over this. In front of, they both prepared very lengthy reports for George Washington when he was president over the propriety of the central bank. And I'm not going to get into that debate, but what I am going to get into is years later, Jefferson, in a series of letters, explained why it was that the advocates of a central bank, such as Alexander Hamilton, wanted a central bank. He called it a permanent engine of corruption, corporate welfare, in other words. And so let me explain what Jefferson meant by that. What he meant by that is Jefferson had observed that as soon as Alexander Hamilton became the first Treasury Secretary, one of the first things he did was to nationalize the war debt held by the states. The Revolutionary War was funded by taxes raised at the state level, and by borrowing by a lot of the individual colonies or states, whatever you want to call them. And some of the states, like Virginia, had almost totally paid off their war debt, but other states, like Massachusetts, had hardly paid any of it at all off. And so the Congress passed a law saying that all the outstanding war debt, which at the time was trading at only between 2 and 10 cents on the dollar, to use dollars as currency at the time. And so they had passed a law saying that the government is going to buy up all that old debt at par value, at face value. And so there were many millions of dollars worth of this outstanding debt. A lot of it had been paid to Revolutionary War veterans in lieu of cash because they didn't have cash. The cash was short. And so there was a lot of this debt out there that was trading at 2 or 3% of par value. But the insiders, the political insiders, knew that in several months, if you had one of these government bonds that you had bought for, say, 2 cents, you could sell it for a dollar. And if you had $1 million worth of these bonds, you could sell it for, $50 million. And so there was a mad rush down the eastern seaboard, stagecoaches, ships of all kinds, horses, as emissaries of the political insiders. The nation's capital at the time was in New York. And so the political insiders, including Hamilton himself, bought up as much of this war debt as they could and then cashed it in. They voted to pay themselves face value of this money that they went out and bought up from the hapless and in the dark Revolutionary War veterans. And so they made a killing. And the main purpose of this, Hamilton said, was he had an agenda, that he and the nationalists had an agenda, and they wanted to use this as a vehicle for buying votes from members of Congress by giving them inside information that would enable them to become very wealthy men. And the agenda was what Hamilton himself called the American system. which was really the rotten, corrupt British system of corporate welfare brought to America. There was nothing inherently American about it. And it involved protectionist tariffs to protect mostly northern businesses from competition from abroad. It involved a central bank that would provide cheap credit to politically connected businesses, and subsidies, corporate welfare, direct subsidies to politically connected corporations. That was mercantilism. But Hamilton called it the American system. And the implication being, well, you're unpatriotic and un-American if you oppose this. Well, the Jeffersonians certainly did oppose it. Well, long after Hamilton's death, though, Jefferson explained in a series of letters that I've written about in my book, Hamilton's Curse, that what Hamilton was doing here and being the champion of a central bank was he recognized that all of these men who had become wealthy, such as Robert Morris, for example, I think he made something like $8 or $9 million in his gambit. He was one of the financiers of the American Revolution, and he was Alexander Hamilton's protege in politics. But anyway, Jefferson understood that these men would all retire or die off eventually, and so the American system would be in jeopardy. They would not be able to get this agenda of full-blown mercantilism put in place if the people whose votes had been bought or purchased through this scam of nationalizing the war debt retired or died. And so Jefferson said a more permanent engine of corruption was necessary. And what would that engine be? It would be a central bank, national bank, that could be used to fund just an infinite amount of corporate welfare. And I think he was dead right on that point. And I published a full-blown academic journal article on this in the Quarterly Journal of Austrian Economics on the corrupt origins of central banking in America, if anyone wants to do a little more detailed reading about it. And so this was cemented into place to some degree, but there remained a huge battle over corporate welfare, Santa Claus economics of this sort for many decades. And what happened in after that, when you get into the 1830s, 1840s, and 50s, is a lot of state governments tinkered with or experimented with corporate welfare for road, canal, and railroad building corporations. And it was a colossal disaster everywhere it was tried. It was such a disaster that every single state, with the exception of Massachusetts, by the time the American Civil War broke out, had amended its constitution to prohibit the use of tax dollars to be given to any corporation for any reason at all. Because states like Illinois, land of Lincoln, when Abe Lincoln was the leader of the Whig Party in the state of Illinois in the 1830s, they got the state legislature to allocate about $11 million supposedly to build roads and canals in 1837. Nothing was finished. Not one road, not one canal was finished. There was a lot of digging going on, but nothing was finished. And much of the money was stolen. And the people of Illinois were put into deep debt for many years to come. That happened in every single state during this time period. And so this system, it was called the Internal Improvements Movement, was a colossal financial disaster everywhere it was tried. And so, but once you get to the Civil War, even though with this knowledge of this, the government adopted an even bigger type of corporate welfare of this sort in the form of railroad subsidies funded by the federal government. And so the Whig Party, in other words, picked up the mantle of the Hamiltonian nationalists, the mantle of corporate welfare, of a government of corporations, by corporations, and for corporations, as long as they are supportive of the government, of the incumbents in the government. That's what the Whigs stood for, and then later the Republicans when Lincoln came in. And so when they did finally succeed, they failed over and over again at the state level, creating all these financial disasters. And the federal government provided almost nothing in terms of corporate welfare until you get to about the time of the American Civil War. But at the time of the American Civil War, though, when Abe Lincoln became president, you know, he was an old railroad lawyer. He was the general counsel for the Illinois Central Railroad. He represented all the major railroads in the Midwest. He was offered the job of a general counsel of the New York Central Railroad in 1857. He was a very wealthy man. He traveled across the Midwest in a private train car, courtesy of the Illinois Central, with an entourage of Illinois Central executives. He wore expensive suits. He lived in the biggest house in Springfield, Illinois. He had servants all throughout the house. His law office was about 100 paces from the state capitol, which tells you a lot about what he did. He was basically a lawyer, a lobbyist, not just a lawyer, but a lawyer lobbyist. And he became president, and one of the first things he did in June of 1861, when the war was on, was to call a special session of Congress to get the ball rolling on the Pacific Railway Act that would provide massive subsidies to railroad corporations. And they did. And so even before the first major battle of First Manassas, the top priority of the Republican Party under Abe Lincoln was to get the ball rolling now that the Southern Democrats were finally out of Congress and who always had been the main opposition to so-called internal improvement subsidies. They wanted to let her rip, so to speak, and they did. And so they finally succeeded in opening the can of worms with federal subsidies to corporations. But until that time, president after president after president had vetoed these things. Jefferson did, Madison did, Monroe, and just all throughout until the 1860s. John Tyler, in the 1840s, the early 1840s, Andrew Jackson, they were all against the use of tax dollars for corporate welfare of any sort because they understood the inherent corruption of such an idea. But then Lincoln and the Republicans, they were the champions of corporate welfare. That's what they lived for. The protectionist tariffs were finally put into place at the 50% level on average and lasted until 1913 when the income tax came in. And so they finally succeeded with that form of corporate welfare, protectionist tariffs, and then also the massive subsidies for the railroads. And what happened then was exactly what the old Jeffersonians had always predicted would happen, was that there would be massive corruption and theft, which there was. And as a result, it resulted in the Crédit Mobilier scandal, that's C-R-E-D-I-T. Second word is M-O-B-I-L-I-E-R, scandal, during the Grant administrations involving the theft of government funds by the people who were running the government-subsidized transcontinental railroads. In the meantime, the great James J. Hill built the Great Northern Railroad without a dime in government subsidy, not even land grants from the government. He paid Indians for the right-of-way across their properties, or what they claimed to be their properties, with livestock, money, whatever they could trade for. And so he proved that an unsubsidized, privately financed transcontinental railroad was possible in the 1870s. And he was competed unfairly with by the government subsidized railroads. But because they were government subsidized, they had so many strings attached, so many regulations attached to what they could do. They weren't able to run their railroads in a profit-maximizing, cost-minimizing manner because of political interference. And so they all became bankrupted at one point during that time. As a result, they were horribly inefficient. But that was really the triumph of mercantilism in America, or Santa Claus economics, if you will, with regard to the corporate sector, really did occur during the Civil War and after the years after the Civil War. And so once the railroad corporations got theirs, every other business of every type began going to Washington, begging for handouts of one form or another. And that's when the word lobbyist is supposedly invented. The story is that the Ulysses S. Grant himself thought of the phrase because these men who represented various corporations who came to Washington to beg for subsidies and handouts hung out in the lobby of the old Willard Hotel, which is still in Washington, D.C. And so Grant called them lobbyists, since they spent all their days and nights hanging out you know, waiting their turn to go and meet with a member of Congress or the president or somebody to beg for a subsidy. And that's why, as my old friend Clyde Wilson said, America was transformed. The image of America was transformed from George Washington on his white horse to a corporate lobbyist in an armchair. And he's referring, of course, to the Lincoln Memorial, the corporate lobbyist in an armchair. And so that was very big. And this continued on. And the American railroad industry really didn't really thrive economically and financially until government finally backed off by the 1890s or so. And became privately financed, privately funded, and we had much more of a genuinely free enterprise system in the railroad business. Not entirely, but for the most part, it was. Even the 25-year-long war against the Plains Indians that was commenced by the U.S. Army immediately after the Civil War ended, literally 3 months after Robert E. Lee surrendered at Appomattox in April of 1865. The U.S. government commenced a 25-year war of genocide against the Plains Indians, and General Sherman himself was in charge of it. And he stated in his memoirs that the purpose was to make way for the government-subsidized railroad. So the estimated death of Indians was between 45 and 60,000 Indians, including many women and children. And so all of that was supposedly done in the name of making way for the railroads. So it was a veiled form of corporate welfare for the railroad industry in the form of killing off 50,000 or so Indians, including many women and children, and placing the rest in concentration camps known as reservations, which exist to this day. And so the genie was out of the bottle, so to speak, for corporate welfare run amok in the late 19th century. And so when you get into the early 20th century, it expanded even further with World War I, with the military-industrial complex. And to fast forward to the New Deal era, the New Deal of the Roosevelt years was essentially the first New Deal from 1933 to 1935 was essentially one big spasm of corporate welfare, because the two key components of the so-called New Deal were the National Recovery Act, which imposed price supports on almost all manufacturing in the United States. It was illegal to cut prices. And the Agricultural Adjustment Administration was the second part of it. And that imposed price supports or prices above free market prices for agriculture products. And so the antitrust laws were suspended. And it was one giant system of attempting to cartelize, to create cartels, government-enforced and government-run cartels in every manufacturing business and every farm in America under the cockeyed theory that the cause of the Great Depression was low prices, therefore high prices will end the Great Depression. That was about the extent of Franklin Roosevelt's understanding of economic theory. And it was such a debacle that both of these things were ruled unconstitutional in 1935 by the United States Supreme Court. And of course, they did nothing to end the Great Depression. In fact, they made the Great Depression worse. There's an old article that I wrote about this in the free market. It's called "A New Deal Debunked Again," and my article is basically a review of an academic journal article from the Journal of Political Economy, which is one of the top peer-reviewed economics journal articles by two top-flight mainstream economists who finally had a V8 juice moment that. Oh my goodness, the Great Depression, the New Deal policies of the Great Depression actually, by trying to create cartels, made things worse. Because what do cartels do, according to mainstream economic theory? They restrict production. That's how they prop up prices. And so these two economists, one of them's named Ohanian, he's one of the editors of the American Economic Review, at the time, it struck them that, well, gee, if you restrict production, the government forces production to fall, well, then the producers won't need as many people to employ either, will they? And so it created more unemployment. And they were ruled unconstitutional, but then similar policies were resurrected by Roosevelt under a different guise. For example, he continued with the policy of paying farmers for not growing food and not raising livestock by calling it soil conservation measures. And so they continued with these types of policies. And they were actually started, though, by Herbert Hoover. Herbert Hoover was the originator of the so-called farm boards, and he also used his office to sort of try to strong-arm politicians into these policies of raising prices and raising wages during the Depression, which is a recipe for unemployment. And in my book, How Capitalism Saved America, I quote Rexford Tugwell, who was FDR's top domestic policy advisor for the duration of his presidency, as saying that what they basically did in the New Deal was to just codify all the things that Herbert Hoover had done. That is, put them into law. Herbert Hoover tried to do a lot of these things, but didn't go as far as Roosevelt did. Roosevelt went much further and got laws passed to codify all these things that Herbert Hoover did or wanted to do. And so these were birds of a feather, Hoover and Roosevelt, on economic policy. And at the time, the reigning economic system of places like Germany and Japan and Italy was fascism. And so America basically adopted economic fascism during the 1930s, which is still, I would argue, the economic system that we have today. Now, economic fascism is a system whereby private property and private enterprise are permitted, but they are very heavily controlled and regimented by government. And the government announces that they must serve a governmental purpose. The purpose of the business is not to satisfy consumers. It is to serve some purpose given to the business by the state, by the government. That's what economic fascism was and is. And so, in fact, Lou Rockwell's latest book that was just published a few weeks ago was on American fascism. And I would highly recommend it to anybody in this class who's interested in following up a little more on our system of corporate welfare that exists to this day. And so the origins of this system were the European system of mercantilism against which the American Revolution was fought. So it's not a stretch to say that the system of corporate welfare is traitorous. At least it was to the founding generation. The Jeffersonians all thought it was not just a bad economic idea, but traitorous to the whole purpose of the founding of the United States. And Hamilton, and we still have today the Hamiltonians. Many of the neocons are proud Hamiltonians who want a government-run economy to some extent. They don't trust free markets. They don't trust individual freedom at all, really. And so this is my rundown of sort of a historical perspective on corporate welfare in America. And as far as some books to read on this, my books, The Real Lincoln and Lincoln Unmasked and How Capitalism Saved America are all about this. To blow my own horn, I'm not going to shy away from blowing my own horn. But I've written several books out there that really are about tell this whole story of the development of this particular type of Santa Claus economics, corporate welfare system in America. And so there's also a good book called The Big Ripoff by Carney. The author's name, I think, is Jim Carney, The Big Ripoff. And it talks about the myriad types of contemporary forms of corporate welfare in America, and that's of all the books I can think of, that's probably the best I could recommend, The Big Ripoff, to learn about the modern version of corporate welfare. And the dangerous thing about this is that so many people who are socialists and totalitarians want to mislead people into thinking that this is what capitalism is. But it's not. It's Adam Smith's famous book, The Wealth of Nations, was, if anything, was a big, long critique of mercantilism and a defense of capitalism. And so those of us who've been advocates of free markets have been doing this for hundreds of years. We've been trying to explain we want to cut back on this. We want to eliminate this. But the critics of free markets always attack a straw man. They always set up these evil, corrupt system of corporate welfare and call that capitalism. And of course, it's unjust, and it's unfair, it's uneconomical, although it does benefit politically connected businesses and their owners. And that's why it prevails so often. And so we've been railing against this for a long time. That's one of the things that's motivated me to write all these books, is to try to provide some resources out there that explains what capitalism is and what capitalism isn't. My book, How Capitalism Saved America, the title I originally proposed to Random House was Real Capitalism, to go along with The Real Lincoln, but they chose How Capitalism Saved America instead. But that was the theme, to distinguish real capitalism from Santa Claus capitalism or corporate welfare. And so, since we only have three live attendees and this is the last class, I think I'll wrap it up. But I think that's all I'll have to say for now for my wrap-up of corporate welfare. And if any of the three have a question or two, I'll entertain a question or two. And if everybody's either watching football, I suppose, or getting ready for Christmas, picking up relatives at the airport and that sort of thing. I see Cam is doing his usual fantastic job of providing links to all the publications that I mentioned. And well, maybe we want to do the Q&A then. Since almost everybody, we have 45 students signed up, and I guess they'll all look at it sometime on their iPhones a little later. But we'll wrap it up then, and thank you all for participating in the course. I hope you learned something, and I hope you learned a lot. I hope you continue your education, and feel free to email me at any time if you have any suggestions of courses that you'd like me or somebody else to put together. We're always interested in what our customers have to say about this. So happy holidays to everybody. Merry Christmas, and have a good weekend. And thanks, Cam and Danny and all the assistants at the Mises Institute. You're all doing a great job, as always.